On this week's show, from Wall Street to construction, with Lisa Diaz from Turf Advisory. In this week's news, does the clock ticking on TikTok have issues for construction? And more.
Construction is the world's oldest industry, but spends the least amount of money on innovation. When we realized people outside the construction industry didn't typically associate construction with technology like virtual reality, apps, and robotics, we started the ConTech Crew. Each week, we bring our listeners the latest in ConTech news and interview the minds behind the technological innovations changing the way we build. So strap in, enjoy the ride, and geek out. It's ConTech Crew time.
All right, we are back. I have Tanis at her home office joining me today. How are you doing, Tanis?
I'm great, Jeff. I'm a little bit sleep deprived. If you remember a few shows back, I mentioned that my husband and I got a puppy. Puppy is now getting closer to a year old, but she is a morning dog and she gets up at 4:30, 5 o'clock and decides it's time to play. And that then means my husband and I are getting up at 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the morning. So coffee is my friend today, but she is sleeping through most of the night. So that's, silver linings, I guess.
There you go. You got a construction dog. Likes to get up early and likes to get out there, right? And get near the job site, you know?
Absolutely.
And we have a special guest this morning, Lisa Diaz. Lisa, say hello to everybody.
Hey, everybody. And welcome to an unconventional conversation, Wall Street and construction. Wow.
Did they ever let's dive right in, like from Wall Street to construction. So give us a little bit of your history and sort of how you got to where you are today.
Okay. So the most important thing, when I was 14 years old, I was working in Robert's Toy Town in Bronxville, New York. And I was investing my money in the bank and I was making no rate of return. So I asked my dad, who's a lawyer, how do I make more money? How do I make my money work for me? He goes, I don't know. I'm a lawyer. Go ask your Uncle Jimmy. So I asked my Uncle Jimmy, who was an entrepreneur, and he talked to me about investing. And you got to go back many moons ago. It wasn't conventional to invest. So he talked to me about buying a stock. What's a stock? A small part of America. And he said, well, is there a company that you like? Do you like their product? Do you like their marketing? Do you think other people too? Anyway, long story short, I bought Dunkin' Donuts because I like the Dunkin' Munchins, which I still do, fast forward many moons later. I also like their marketing, and I found out they owned their real estate. And I was hooked on the investment rate of return scenario. I made good money for a 14-year-old, and what it gave me is freedom and power. And so when I graduated from college, I wanted to use this passion into Wall Street. So I worked at Goldman Sachs, where I was a managing director in the securities business. And one of the things that happens on Wall Street is once you get to a certain age, which we're not going to talk about, you know, people tend to get managed out. So I was thinking about what did I want to do for my next chapter. Remember, I started working when I was 14. The only times I took off were my two maternity leaves. And I plan to work until at least I'm 90 or maybe 95. So one day I was going through Grand Central and I missed my train. And I saw this tourist tour and I just kind of went along with it. And I found out that Jackie Onassis saved Grand Central from ruin. I was like, wow, I love Jackie Onassis. And you watch also weddings and great things happen, this great testament to humanity, this stage that New Yorkers and many tourists go to. The second thing is in the main vista, there's a black spot, and it's a reference to a construction worker who came up with an idea that you could use lemon to clean the ceiling. So I get on my train, I think about it, and I say to my husband, I want to work in construction. He's like, you don't know anything about construction. I'm like, no problem. I went to Wall Street as a Soviet studies major. I'll figure it out. So what attracted me about construction was it was a large addressable market. So it's about 5% of GDP. I like the fact that it was a very low margin, so that means lots of upside. And I like the fact that it was among the least digitized industries. So versus farming, second is construction. And so I went down this path. I got an WBE, and I learned that in construction, it's an apprenticeship program. I created one for myself. And fast forward 8 years later, I've developed, not like you, Tanis, but I've developed a keen sense of how to curate technology solutions with the mindset of how do you improve those margins, efficiency, so you can pay more money to the system. And I'm a huge fan of people that actually build things in America. In Wall Street, we invest in things, but we don't actually build things. And that is the tradesmen who really should get the high five from the population.
Well, that is well said, and and we need more of those Wall Street minds. I think the people with the idea of money working for them coming from Wall Street, and I mean, Tanis, you had to love this, to be seen as that next viable option. We can discuss whether, you know, there is this thing about people moving on at that at certain time, but we are a very big viable option for all those reasons that you hit, Lisa. So, but you do have a little bit of an unconventional look at that. So what are some of the things that you go in and do as an advisory group to help construction companies? Where are they leaving money on the ground?
Well, one of the biggest challenges for construction tech companies, which is the majority of our clients, is how do they grow? If you talk to any venture capitalist, their first question is, what is your ARR? So that's your annual recurring revenue. And to sell into construction technology is not for the faint of heart. As you know, Tanis, during your startup period, it's, what did you say, quote unquote, being punched in the face is a tough endeavor. So what we do is a combination of boots on the ground with a very nuanced B2B strategy, because I'm a huge LinkedIn fan, as I think you are as well, from the followers you had. So what we do is, first of all, we curate technology companies that follow real pain points or have solutions on job sites. I'm not an advocate of technology for technology's sake. People are creatures of habit, me too. Unless there is a pain point that is someone is willing to change, they're just going to keep on doing things the way they've done it before. So the company has to solve a pain point. Secondly, the entrepreneur, we like to find people that have experience on construction sites who understand some of the challenges and can speak to the end users. And they have to have a high level of discipline. You're getting up early with your puppy. I get up early to go rowing. So I go rowing every morning, and you need to get up there when nobody is willing to do the hard work, be by yourself, flip the boat. So we want to have people that know, that have the grit to be able to move forward. So once we find those companies, we use our WBE network to go to, various events, Meet the Primes within the tri-state area. And we've also recruited turf crew members who work for us on a part-time basis in other markets. So we have those one-on-one contacts. And frankly, our objective is to find decision makers who want to buy our construction technology. We then complement that with a B2B strategy, where our first objective is to find the ideal customer profile. So we work to find out who's the right fit, and using artificial intelligence, we reach out and connect with to create qualified leads. You probably know there's a billion users on LinkedIn. It is the profile for business, and we use that in concert with the boots on the ground to generate quality leads. And the open rate, you probably know that for email, is about 22%. For LinkedIn, it's 58%. So it's three times more effective. And then our connection rate is over 30%. So we're able to connect with those core end users with the objective and vision to sell these construction technology solutions to deliver growth. And that's crucial for funding, which you're going to need to grow further. So that's what TURF does.
Awesome. Tanis?
So I love the concept of targeting pain points that people are willing to change. And I have chatted with so many brilliant technology entrepreneurs and companies that are building really cool solutions, but they are targeting pain points that are either somewhat obscure and difficult to vocalize or explain, or that people are just not willing to change. And I had a great conversation with my friend yesterday about Excel spreadsheets. And he mentioned that it doesn't matter the size of the project or the size of the organization. There is always going to be somebody in the room who is just emotionally attached to Excel. And that becomes a difficult point to navigate because they have a very visceral response when you say you're going to do something that's taking their Excel spreadsheet away. And while we all know that we shouldn't be managing very large projects in Excel, it is a pain point that some are unwilling to change, and trying to sell into an organization that's not willing to make that pivot, whether it's Excel or something else that is a legacy tool and people are really emotionally attached to, becomes really difficult, especially for startups where your resources are quite limited. And you know, you can't spend 12 months chasing a customer, hoping at some point you can advocate and educate enough that they're going to convert into a paying company. So how do you coach your tech companies to identify those pain points that organizations are willing to change? Is there some sort of market survey that you guys are consistently doing, or are you kind of collecting feedback as teams are out there talking to organizations?
I mean, in a perfect world, I would love to coach these tech startups, but I started out, I'm a capitalist, right? You need to make money. You need to pay your people. You need to move forward. So the approach we really do is much more, we've developed a group of construction evangelists, construction advocates. And so we talk to them on a regular basis to find out what are their pain points, right? So my favorite call is like, I'm not going to give the name. So someone called me up and said, look, I got this great new job. I'm in charge of innovation. These are the three problems I need to solve. What can you do to help me? So that's a perfect pain. So the person has the power and has been given the authority to make changes. And then they have very core, clear, articulated pain points. Because I'm a mother of two children, and I learned, especially when they turned 13, you need to like, what's in it for them? What do they want to do? Because even if it's the greatest thing in the world that you should do XYZ thing, people don't do that, right? I mean, how many people start diets and stop diets, or they decide to go on exercise, they don't. So until it's a pain point that they perceive, not you perceive, it's not going to have any solution. And you know, one of the things that I observed is there are these tech serial founders. And silly me, I assumed if you were a tech serial founder, it meant you start a company, you made money, you start another company, you made money, you start. This is not, in fact, the case. There's an archetype in Silicon Valley who are serial tech founders, because when interest rates were close to zero, they could just keep on, you know, finding somebody else to, you know, pay or finance their exploration. I don't think that's no longer the case. But so again, I really think that one is in business to make money. And so if you're going to work with a construction tech company that's not solving a pain point, that's not somebody that TURF wants to do business with. We only have limited capacity. We have our reputation, and our success comes from repeat business. And if you're not, again, solving pain points that many people feel, they're not going to take your call anymore. They're not going to want to do your demo. And that defeats the point of being a growth advisory company.
Yeah, you really, we have a lot of solutions looking for a problem. And
exactly.
And I'm sure, Tanis, you and I could name off a few of those serial founders out there that, you know, we're just taking advantage of a really unique time too.
Yeah.
I mean, some incredible exploration happened, and I think down the road we're going to see some benefits from it. I think some of the things Tanis gets really excited about with robotics, et cetera, you know, that time may have implanted some true possibilities. But, you know, I was looking through the companies that you guys work with, and I'm pretty familiar with a few of them, Riskcast being one of my favorite. So I'm really excited to see, and I can see, understand how Alec and you would hit it off, you know, being very focused on making money, but solving a real pain point and growing at a rate that makes sense. I mean, Alec has been around on the circuit, and I've known him for quite a long time. Actually, he helped me go out on my own here, in this venture, you know, gave me a lot of advice. So, I'm just interested in, if you're not looking, is there an archetype you do see in the founder space that makes you say, oh, that's somebody.
Oh yeah. 100%.
Those are the people I want to work with.
100%. Okay. There are three things I'm looking for, right? The first one is product market fit. You know, they're solving a real problem. The second thing is, are they good at explaining their value proposition? And as much as, you know, one of the challenges is some engineers are not as good on the EQ communication side. And that's a really important skill set, because we all, the people that we follow, are storytellers. Like, leaders are storytellers. They come up with a vision, you buy into the plan, you move forward, right? And I told you, Jeff, I just watched Napoleon, which I highly recommend on Apple TV. Napoleon was a great leader. He was able to come up with his plan and vision, and the soldiers fell into line. They went to war and died for him. So one of the things I want to look at is someone that can actually communicate the message, that you can instill confidence, communication, because that's the difference between, you know, someone winning or losing in getting a client, you know, to sign on to use their technology. And the third one is really the discipline. As Tanis mentioned, when you're an entrepreneur, and I hear my friends at Goldman Sachs complaining all the time, life is tough. Like, sorry, okay? If you're at a big corporation, you don't have to worry about health insurance. You don't have to worry where your next paycheck's coming through. You don't have to worry about losing a client, having to fire your team. It's much harder to be an entrepreneur. So you need to look at an entrepreneur that has grit. They have tenacity. They have resilience. Again, going back to rowing, the boat flips, you're in polluted water. How are you gonna get back in the boat? How are you gonna like pick yourself up after you lose and figure out how to do it again and again and again? And it's those very small changes which make you succeed on the water, but in life. So I really put a very, very high premium on tenacity and someone who can take lemon and make lemonade. Because if you're a frail flower, this is not the place for you. And then put in construction, that's a double negative. So yeah, that's, and like Alec is case in point, right? He's not for the frail of heart. I admire the fact that he's bootstrapped, he's self-funded, he comes from industry. He's a very, very articulate spokesperson of the value proposition of RiskCast. He's super hardworking, he's tenacious, check, check, check.
I like it. I mean, Tanis, you've got to be able to empathize with that quite a bit, given your journey.
I certainly can. It's, you know, being an entrepreneur is kind of, and I've heard other people say it as well, it's kind of like riding a roller coaster. Sometimes you're on cloud nine, sometimes you're just holding on for dear life and hoping everything goes according to plan. Because, you know, to your point, Lisa, you have to have grit. You have customers relying on you. You have employees relying on you. And you're wandering sometimes through a space of uncertainty, and you have to make the best decisions in the moment with the information that you have. It's not for the faint of heart. And I often hear them called soft skills. They are just skills when it comes to being an entrepreneur. The communication, the leadership, you know, the ability to connect with people, having emotional intelligence, those aren't soft skills. Those are skills that are absolutely necessary to navigate that space. And the technical aspect of it is important, and finding a problem to solve is critical. But if you can't connect with people and sell your vision, and, you know, to your point, Lisa, I haven't watched Napoleon yet, but I'm really looking forward to it. Have people follow you and share that vision and get excited about it. If you can't do those things, your journey is going to be very short, and you might end up founding 20 or 30 companies along the way, but, you know, ultimately you're not going to hit that market fit. So I'm going to flip Jeff's question on its head. You have three things that you look for in that key archetype. Is there an aspect of an entrepreneur that if somebody demonstrated those three qualities, you would still walk away from an opportunity to support that organization? Is there something that, you know, maybe it's ego or something like that, that if you saw it, you were just like, nope, that's not going to be a good fit for us?
Okay, this is my Goldman Sachs training. You're wrong. I really put ethics and wanting to leave a legacy very, you know, high on the list. If I felt that someone didn't have the right motivation and they were willing to, you know, sell their mother, brother for the great, you know, in pursuit of their own ego, I guess the ego thing, I would walk away from that. I have a very hard time with accepting that. And I think behaving in a reasonable way. And to part of being a leader, and success comes from being a leader, you have to think about the success of other people. And if someone who's an egomaniac is never going to be able to build and grow a powerful organization. So that would be a negative point. The other thing I walk away from is the blame game. So when you're a leader, even if it's not your fault, you got to take a bullet. You always have to take the bullet. And the type of personality type that's blaming other people, that doesn't take responsibility, that's another, like, I will walk away from someone like that. And the third point is, do you follow through with what you say? So a lot of people are like, oh, I can do this, that, and the other thing, blah, 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 blah. Like, lots of talk, no execution skills. If someone does not demonstrate execution skills, I'll walk away from that too. And I should say, Tianis, like, these are all characteristics I expect from myself. I don't ask anybody to do anything that I don't are not willing to do. And maybe the bar is a little high, but like, that's the way we roll. And we are looking to change the world and to demonstrate the need for technology. And also, you know, I'm self-professed as a woman. I'm very adamant about showing, in particularly in a male-dominated world. I came from finance. I go to construction. I like the male-dominated world, but it's a tougher crowd. How many women, what's the percentage of women in construction? 14%, 13% on a good day? You know, clearly there's a lot of wood to chop, and it's pretty similar to finance. So I'm very aware that people are watching you. And if you're being watched as a leader, the bar is higher. So someone who does not willing to compete at that high level, not for me.
I really think those are some high quality pieces that we need. We've seen far too many, I think, startups or technology companies, not just in construction, by the way, everywhere, that get about halfway to a great business, maybe even really good valuation. But eventually it comes crumbling down. You can't be narcissistic and think you can hold up the world. It's just not possible. In fact, I think, you know, I'm a huge Simon Sinek and Brené Brown fan. And I think one of Simon's pieces about creating your inner circle that dawned on me as I've been through the journey is, you know, it's also great that we have leaders who know exactly what they're not good at, right? And that they surround themselves with those people. They don't, you know, you don't walk in the room and see three perfectly, like, the exact same people running the company. That's not actually a good look. You need a diversity of mind, thought, et cetera, to be well-rounded. So I'm interested, do you focus on how those entrepreneurs, how those founders surround themselves with other people
to grow? 100%. You are the depth of you are the company you keep. You are the depth and breadth of your bench. And to your point, if everybody like looks like you, they're going to think like you. And I'm very much in the business case for diversity. And if you look at innovation, you've looked at any of the academic journals on innovation, it comes from people looking at the same problem with a different point of view, because all of us have unconscious bias. It's not just white men. It's everybody. Everyone looks at the world through their lens, right? And there's a book from Jonathan Lear on that innovation, which really struck me. And he talks about 3M. And what 3M does is when they have a problem, they or this is their strategy, they have engineers that have some knowledge, but not deep knowledge on solving the problem. And they bring them to solve the problem. So without unconscious bias, they've come up with all different solutions. So some of the things they talked about was like post-it notes, okay? Like that was like a big game changer that came from innovation, or scotch tape, right? And all these things that seem like very, you know, obvious are not so obvious when one has an unconscious bias. So as you look for entrepreneurs, you want to have ones that have different points of view. Like me, I am not a digital native, okay? But I understand it's really important. So I surround myself with digital natives. And I like being around younger people, because younger people challenge my worldview. They show me things I had never thought about myself. So you want to, I like to look at leaders that have diversity, but in background, but also in age, because there's some value to history and there's value to what happens before. Cause like one of the things that happens with, you know, the very young entrepreneur, and this happened before in the internet bubble, they want to like recreate the world. They're not leaning on the history of people that's come before them, which is another kind of challenge slash problem. And when the first internet bubble came, I remember that there were all these, you know, kind of Silicon Valley types, and they were Wall Street types, and they decided they want to do marketing. Like, hello, what's your expertise in marketing? Why don't you hire someone who knows something about marketing? So I don't know if that answers your question, but the whole benefit, you know, there's a correlation between innovation and diversity. It's having, how do you get away from unconscious bias? And getting away from unconscious bias delivers what I care about, ROI, growth, performance, execution.
Construction in general is a highly stressful environment, and you see the stress, and you always get the I'm fine answer, but always try to dig a little deeper, because people say, you know, I haven't been sleeping great, and I'm really eating crappy food, and I feel anxious, I feel depressed, I feel, you know, we'll start to really get into those conversations and figure out what's going on. There's some great resources. And if you go to brentdarnell.com/resources, first, there's an emotional intelligence and physical symptom survey test. So we get your emotional profile and we get your physical profile based on physical symptoms, and we tell how your body's working. And then we can correlate those two. And if burnout, if you're experiencing burnout, it will show up in probably both of those evaluations. It's free. You just download it and do it. And just so see where you are. And if you have burnouts, the top two or three that pop up and show up there, I would pay attention and start to really look at what are you doing with stress and nutrition and sleep and exercise and daily reflection and those kinds of things that we know we need to do to keep us healthy and keep us sane and keep us on track.
You've got to check in with where you are. You've got to work on balancing. It's not about the diagnosis. It's about preventing people from getting too far down the road. Like most of our construction folks that listen in, they take care of their cars. They keep them up to date. You know, this is no different. You've got to put in the maintenance on the body, on the mind, because you're racing this car around the track, right? We're not going to change that we're a bunch of race cars out there, but we can change that we do the right maintenance, take the right time, and really check in.
One more resource in there, the Tough Guy Survival Kit, guy being gender neutral. It's specifically written geared toward more field folks, but there's a really great chapter on stress management and peak performance in there. And it talks about meditation techniques and mindfulness techniques and breathing techniques.
I like that. That's really tied to the execution. I was at a DBIA national conference last year, and Duncan Wardle from Disney spoke, and they were expanding into China, and they were getting a group of people, and it was the same group of people they always got in the room. And it was part of his process and maybe some of the others at Disney to just grab a couple random people. And he grabbed this random woman, and she was in there, and everybody had everybody draw everything, and everybody drew everything the same except for her. She drew like some odd character that was like a teacup. And then she wrote distinctly Disney, authentically Chinese. And had they not brought this person in, and that became the tagline when they took Disney to China, and had they not brought this other, I think, very inexperienced, completely outside of the world they were using in to do it, they would have never had it. So you never know where those innovations are going to come from. I do want to make sure that we take some time, because you've done this, and you are about the ROI, and you are about growing companies, and you know, you do have the Wall Street background, but you also have a give back approach. And that's what connected us, was, you know, you're working heavily with the Boys and Girls Club of Mount Vernon. Yes. And so tell us a little bit about your passion for giving back and your passion for that project.
Well, the person I admire most in my life is my grandmother, who is deceased. But when my grandmother was a serial Helping Humanity, and when she was 82 years old, She saw a homeless person and their daughter in a park in Hart Park. And she's like, and she's from Ireland, not in the greatest country in America. So she brought these people back to her house, and it was a launch of her soup kitchen. So she got all the women from the church were Catholic, and she started her mission to give back to humanity, right? So in her heyday, my grandmother used to be the Mother Teresa of Hart Park and feed like 350, 400 people. She was powerful. When she died, her charity has continued to today. So I always wanted to be my grandmother because I just love my grandmother. And so when I graduated from college, I used to volunteer at St. Bartholomew's, which is a homeless shelter, for like 2 years. And it kind of came to me, as much as I wanted to be my grandmother, I was me. And my grandmother liked to give people fish. I want to help them catch fish. So through my whole career and life, I'm all about education, teaching young people. Again, I want to make fishermen. And I got involved in the Boys and Girls Club of Mount Vernon because there was a Smart Cities projects we were working on. And I heard across the board, Mount Vernon is about half an hour north of Manhattan. They have 40% food insecurity, which frankly, I didn't even know what it meant. It meant that 40% of the people don't know where their next meal is coming from. Graduation rates from high school are less than 50%. And these high schools are not sending people to Harvard, Princeton, and Yale. And it's a very challenged environment, like, you know, high crime rates across the board. So I kept on hearing about this Boys and Girls Club of Mount Vernon. That was the place. And so I went, and I think I knocked on the door and I'm like, can I be a board member? And they said yes. And it's Denzel Washington's club. He's from Mount Vernon. And that was the inflection point. And if you look, he's a spokesperson for the Boys and Girls Club of Mount Vernon. And there's a very touching video about him and this guy, Billy Thomas, who changed his life. And so I was very much gravitated that here's this community, and Westchester County is for super rich people. Right next door is a very wealthy community that don't even know what's happening in Mount Vernon. So I've been involved since 2017, and I'm trying to create more fishermen. One of the big challenges in Mount Vernon is everybody wants to be Denzel Washington. Denzel, me too. Sign me up. If you want to be Denzel too, Mrs. Diaz wants to do it any which way. He's super cool and like looks, he's a great guy. And the other, you know, the other thing they all want to be is an NBA star, because there's a whole bunch of NBA stars that have come from Mount Vernon. But the chances of one being either Denzel or an NBA star, not so good. So one of the things we're working on in the club is we're going to redo the club, is we want to create a makerspace. And a makerspace will be a place where you can teach construction and open their eyes. And hopefully what will happen is the youth will see that there's an alternative, a path forward other than being Denzel or being an NBA star. And you can make, what, $200,000, $250,000 being an electrician, being a plumber. I don't think any of them have any idea that this is on the horizon. So part of what we're hoping to do with the club is to look at different career pathways. So unlike my grandmother that likes to feed, I want to teach them to fish. And construction, I think, is going to be a very great career path. The average age of a construction worker is 48 years old. They're getting older at a faster rate than a lot of other industries. And young people like technology. They like think, oh, wow, this is cool. So hopefully, if things go according to plan, we're going to attract a universe of construction workers, technologists that come out of Mount Vernon, and it can increase and give more career optionality to the kids at the Boys and Girls Club of Mount Vernon.
That's a fantastic initiative. And Jeff and I talk quite frequently about the need to expose young people to opportunities in our industry much earlier than, you know, they end up happenstance coming across them if they don't have family members that work in construction or close family friends. And we see these initiatives in some high schools. You know, you're hitting kids at 16, 17 years old. Some of them have already decided on a career path at that point, or they're pretty confident in which direction they want to go. And others just may not have an interest in it and haven't been exposed to it and therefore aren't going to go down that path. So this is fantastic because your demographic from what I understand of the Boys and Girls Club is much broader than just, juniors and seniors in high school. So yeah. You're making that connection at a much earlier age and inspiring an interest and curiosity. And though those children may not pursue careers in construction, but some of them will. And I remember back to the time I was in high school, I didn't have shop class or anything like that. I had family members in the industry. That's what drew me into construction. But I actually had a school counselor that told me to go do something else. So my original plan, I was going to go to law school. I had a path picked out. I was going to work in construction just to kind of pay for school and work my way through. And lo and behold, here I am 23 years later. And I just never left. I fell in love with it. But I wish I would have had that opportunity at a much younger age. So that's absolutely phenomenal. I love to hear that. So I have a question around industry support. Are you getting support from any local contractors or organizations to help kind of bolster the effort and exposing young people to construction?
A line of people want to help is huge. So one of the other things, I'll tell you my like whole big game plan. So we want to create a maker lab. And it's really modeled after the product realization lab at Stanford University, where my daughter's at. And I got to tell you my own story. Like everything at Stanford University is very hoity-toity. It's like state of the art, whatever. So my daughter's like, Mom, you have to come and see the product realization lab. This is the makerspace of Silicon Valley. So I was expecting all this really fancy stuff. So I walk in and it's like wood making, welding, like it's not looking what my expectations will be. And I will never forget. So I'm in the corner with my daughter and her friend, who is a 2 or 3 time gold medalist. So the two of them are going on and on about how hard welding is. And I'm like, wait a second, let me understand what's happening here at Stanford University. Okay. First of all, this place is not looking very, upmarket. Second of all, here's the two of them. And I was like, can I ask a question? And they're like, sure. I'm like, so do you admire people in the trade? They're like, oh my God, they're artists. They do all this amazing thing. You know how hard this welding is? And it looked like a frame to me. And they're going on and on and on about this welding thing. And I was like, wow. So all of a sudden the light goes off. I'm like, can I ask just like a clarifying question? I was like, so the whole purpose of this product realization lab is for you guys to get hands-on experience in building and designing the next generation of things in the U.S., in the world. And they're like, yeah. So we really admire in a very high level the tradespeople. And I was like, oh, now I get it. So it's that getting on an equal playing field. And I came back to New York, and I don't know if any of you have seen the J.P. Morgan headquarters. They had this 60,000 ton big steel welding. So I sent it to my daughter and I was like, this is super cool, right? She's like, oh my God, that's so amazing. But if they didn't have the experience of building this looking like a frame, they would never appreciate like how difficult it is. You can imagine how you could build something, but to actually do it is something very different. So what we want to do in the product realization lab at the Boys and Girls Club of Mount Vernon is to create that same environment of learning and exploration. And some of the kids may be, be a construction worker. Maybe they design the next greatest building thing in the world. But that's only going to happen if there's respect from both sides of the equation. And then the third thing we want to do is there's an organization which totally touches my heart called NEW. It's Non-Traditional Employment for Women. And they're looking to have a facility somewhere in Westchester County. So the plan, God willing, is that in the morning when the kids are not there, we would rent the space to NEW. So you would have the mothers of the kids at Mount Vernon, hopefully decide that they want to have a career in construction, and then they send their kids. So it's a virtuous circle. Because one of the problems, as I see it, is we overplayed, You got to go to college. You got to go to college. You got to go to college. Like, not everybody is set up for going to college. Like, that's okay. And in Europe, it's okay to go down the academic versus a technical path. So I think we need to convince the kids it's okay to be in construction. But you also got to convince the parents that it's okay to be in construction. Because I'm a parent myself, and, you know, parents are like, want to make the kid the best they can be. And so the parents need to understand is that being a construction worker is like a really good job. It's a good future. It's a good career. And I'm not so sure we have communicated that message. You know, it's all like college, college, college. Did you go to college? Got to go to college. You know, it's starting to change, but I think we need to increase that conversation.
Are you a construction company that's inundated with applications? Are you struggling to get technology adoption? Are you worried you're creating data silos? We refer to that as gray work. You want to learn more about gray work and how leading construction companies are getting past it? Then join me at QuickBase's Empower 2024. Go to quickbase.com/empower.
Yeah, it's funny. Tanis, we have had this conversation quite a bit, but in the entire process, it never dawned on me to really look at the Boys and Girls Club, especially because, you know, it's a you know, nationwide program here. And so there's chapters everywhere. And so one chapter being successful becomes a model for others to be successful. And you're right, Lisa, part of this problem is that we as parents, I'm a parent as well, want the best for the next generation. And sometimes we're blinded to our own biases that, you know, we've said it here quite a bit, that the plumber or the electrician are, you know, that those are less than routes. And it's like, no, they're actually on par or more than, because, you know, I had a conversation with an executive for a mechanical company that had founded his own mechanical company. And really he had the guts to start his own mechanical company because he was a plumber and because he was a welder and because he could do those things. He said, you know, it was a risk to start it, but hey, at the worst case, you know, I just go back to welding and go back to, you know, installing pipe and I'll be all right. So I can take a risk. And what a great foundation to allow others to have the financial capabilities and the skill sets, right? You know, just think about all the skills that come along outside of welding when you're learning a craft. You know, you're doing estimation, you're doing progress tracking, you're just being exposed to so many different tools and responsibilities that, you know, an 18-year-old going to college, nobody's, you know, especially at the big schools, nobody's checking in that you came to class or not. You know, these folks have to show up and you have a job and you have to produce and you have to learn. And yeah, it's a fantastic pathway. So where, because I want to let people connect with you. Where can people connect with you, Lisa, so they can find out more about what you're doing and then what's going on at the Boys and Girls Club of Mount Vernon? And hopefully some of our listeners out there, y'all want to get involved, because we're always a
fan
of recruit
people. Involved. We need your help. We need your inspiration. We need your energy. So best place to get in touch with me is LinkedIn. So it's Lisa. My maiden name, Giuffra, it's G-I-U-F-F-R-A Diaz. I aspire to have as many followers as Tanis, but I'm not there yet. So please come and, you know, follow me. And there's a lot of posting about the Boys and Girls Club and rowing and construction. The other thing is Turf Advisory. Just Google us. We're always interested in learning about new technology solutions. And the Boys and Girls Club, I think, would be very, very open. It's the Boys and Girls Club of Mount Vernon. If you want to get involved, please knock on our doors, help. And you can really make a difference in the lives of kids. And we didn't talk about this, but I'm a cancer survivor. And, you know, when you get cancer, I'm just, truth be told, I had breast cancer and my three very close friends died of breast cancer. So I had my operation and then they were supposed to tell me if it spread. So of course I decide that it was on a Friday. They're like, you have to wait till Monday. So I was convinced I was dying and they didn't want to tell me because I'm neurotic, right? So I had my tears and then I was like, okay, so I have to prepare for my funeral. What am I going to do? And I mentioned I have two daughters and I remembered at my father's funeral where there were like three people who reached out to me and was like, your father's my mentor. And I felt like part of my father would, you know, kind of continue in these people. And I am, again, a serial mentor. So I said, okay, if I'm going to die, how are my kids going to know where to like connect with these people? Anyway, so what I ended up doing was I write this email, and there were like 60 or 70 that I post my kids. They're like, Mom, what is wrong with you? Why are you? So then after I'm fine, I was like, I'm preparing for my funeral. They're like, you are crazy. I'm like, you know what? This is the legacy I want to leave. And so I think everyone needs to think about like when they're not here, because, you know, we're all on our journey. It's short. How do you do the work back? What do you care about? Can you take lemon and make it into a positive thing? So having cancer made me even more committed to doing a legacy. And I'm aspiring someday when I die, it's going to happen. There'll be some people who come and there'll be construction workers. And they'll be like, hey, I went to the Boys and Girls Club of Mount Vernon and your mother told me it was okay for me to be a construction worker. I'm like, no, I admire you for being a construction worker. So the point is we all have points in our lives that things don't do according to plan. And you can decide to either feel bad for yourself and have a pity party. Okay. That's, or you can say, God is handing me something that's difficult. And leaders are people who swallow the bad medicine and figure out how to move forward, how to make it better. So I guess this is a call to action. I'm, you know, inspired by the Boys and Girls Club and the work that's been done there. Come join us. We need your help. America needs your help to build it back better and to make a difference and to have various career pathways. Not everybody should work in finance. Not everybody should be a lawyer. People should think about being a plumber, electrician, and they're building things that last. That Grand Central Station is going to be here in 50 years, probably 100 years. How amazing. And one of my goals is I want to have a little role in, like, they're going to redo the bus terminal in New York. Mark my words, it's going to be a destination. Or go down to Ground Zero. That place was horrible. I was at 9/11. It was not a happy place. It's an inspiration. It's been rebuilt. It's been re-inspired. So we need more of that in our country. And to do it, guess what we need? Construction workers. We're waiting for you.
Well, I'm just going to let that be the mic drop moment, Tanis. I don't think we can say anything else. Lisa, it's been fantastic. It's been wonderful to meet you, to sit down and interview you. Can't thank you enough. And I'm guessing my listeners will be as touched as we were to just learn about your path. And thank you for what you're doing in construction. And I think everybody who drives down a road, crosses a bridge, or goes into a building and it doesn't fall on them can thank construction workers for, you know, the women and men in the field for that right. So with that, we're going to get into the construction technology news of the week. Back in 2020, I heard about a new software platform called Join. Within minutes of seeing Join, I knew it had the power to revolutionize collaborative project delivery. In fact, I was so sold on Join that I joined the team as its industry evangelist. Many trade shows and podcasts later, Join is now used by 50% of the ENR top 30. Why? Pre-con and ops leaders at DPR, Bolt, McCarthy, Barton Mallow, Clark, and others say that they like Join because it does two big things: collaborative, trackable decision-making, and awesomely simple visuals. Want to learn more about the power of Join? Go to www.join.build/demo to learn about how better gets built. Tanis, what do you got?
So I've got a couple good ones this week. First one is from Construction Briefing. Why construction is tired, in quotations, of seeing tech that isn't available to use. And we've all been there. We've all seen the marketing hype. We go to conferences. We try out all this cool technology. And then you go out to site and you don't see any of it actually there being used by the crews. So the gap between ideation and exploration and getting word of advancement out to the industry to actually deploying that technology on site certainly exists. And that's normal product development. Things take time. They don't all happen overnight, but we've all heard from construction project managers, construction managers, skilled trades professionals that they're waiting. They're excited about the use of technology. You know, construction often gets a bad rap about being tech adverse and, you know, construction workers don't want to use tech. That is not true. If you walk around a construction site and you talk to skilled trades professionals, they absolutely are interested in using tech, but tech that solves real problems, to Lisa's point earlier. They don't want tech for the sake of tech. They don't want something that's going to make 10 extra steps in their process. They're already really busy. They want tech that solves problems. And if you can provide that, they're excited about it. But they're also recognizing that, you know, the actual deployment cycle on some of these solutions is becoming quite long. So call to action in the industry, you know, don't just market the tech. Don't throw it on LinkedIn and talk about it. Use it, pilot it, get feedback from those skilled professionals that are actually out there, boots on the ground, making things happen, building a legacy and leaving their mark on the industry. Get it in their hands, let them use it, get some feedback, and let's start seeing some of those adoption rates increase. We're seeing improvement, but we're not moving the needle enough on actual use. Jeff, what do you think?
Well, I love this. This is about one of our former guests and a friend of mine, Brikin Kapalanoglu at Oracle. And Oracle really did something extremely fantastic with building the Innovation Center. It's an active construction job site, and they really are doing applied technology, right? And that's what I saw in there is the call out that, you know, many places they'd seen technology before, it never looked like a construction site, right? You were doing it in a boardroom, you were doing it inside the office, and it just, oh yeah, this thing works great here. This sensor works great. Yeah, but it's not dirty, it's not dusty. There's nothing else going on around. So it's really putting it into the real hands so we can make sure, you know, that it's impacting the day-to-day. Far too much of what we do in technology is too far ahead. It's the rubber is just not hitting the road, and we need it to hit the road because that's, to Lisa's point, where the ROI is, right? That's where we've got to get it. I also think too, kind of a commonality from our conversation we just had is Oracle's Innovation Lab was originally just a construction site. Now they've actually gone out and gotten all their different verticals under one roof. So you'll have multiple different verticals that are housed close to one another for that exact thing that we were talking about earlier. Now, one of these people in another industry could solve our problems just through cross-pollination, through having a cup of coffee and complaining about something and have some go, well, you ever tried this? So really great to see that we're doing this. And hey, it looks like they have three now. So they have one in the UK, the one in Chicago, which was the original, and then one in Sydney, Australia. So just an incredible way. And Lisa, I'm interested in your takes, given that you're looking at building a makers lab and you've now had the experience at Stanford. This kind of lines right up with what you've been talking about.
100% lines up. Exactly. You need to have a hands-on experience. And we talked about before, innovation comes from a different perspective. And it's that very marginal, you see the world in a different way. So kudos to Oracle. I want to go visit that place in Chicago. Way cool. Super cool.
I think we can connect you to make that one happen. So Brikin, you're hearing it here. Find Lisa. If you can't find her, you know how to connect with me, buddy. We'll we'll make sure you two get together and we'll get a, maybe I'll join you and we'll go for a tour out there check out the lab.
But you know, having those experiences like are transformational. Like I went to my first topping out ceremony. I didn't know, like when you work on Wall Street, like I don't even know what this means, right? It was so cool. So it was a Cardinal site. It's in Brooklyn. Voyage Control, which is another one of our clients, they do digital management delivery system. So it's in a very congested area. So we go in, we go up the hoist. I thought that was pretty cool. And it's this big, you know, open space. And the thing that happens is I ask all these different people, I'm like, so what do you think about Voyage Control? They're like, wow, we love voyage control. I'm like, okay, verification of our, and like one after another, right? So then we go to sit at this table and all right, my Spanish is not like 100%, but I can get by like pretty okay because my husband's Argentine. We're talking to these, you know, some of the boots on the ground and they don't understand. So I figured out they speak Spanish, right? So during this conversation, I asked them about voyage control. So it was a great ideation moment because I said to the founder, James Swatson, I was like, you should do this in Spanish because half of the workers on this site are not speaking English. So during the topping out ceremony, they would have like the project executive first talks in English and there's one in Spanish. It goes back and forth. So that's one of the examples of when you have real life experience. Like if I hadn't been at this topping out ceremony and happened to like see the need for Spanish speaking, you know, usage in technology on construction sites. So you need to kind of be there and get the inspiration from the people that are using this product.
Absolutely right. In fact, and I think, you know, not to jump into an AI topic, because we almost got all the way here without AI, but the natural language processing, the NLPs are really, and are going to really help out with that, you know, ability to switch things so people can do things more rapid in other languages. And you're right. I mean, and construction is an international language. So if you're only looking at the US for your construction software, well, you're looking at a good market, but there's a lot more out there. Tanis, what else you got for us today?
So my second news of the week is not actually a news story. It's a report that was just recently published by Lumber. It's called She Builds Nation 2024. And this came out right after WIC Week. So Women in Construction Week just wrapped up last week. And it highlights some pretty interesting statistics that I thought would be, you know, quite a good topic to discuss today, considering we have two women in construction on the call and Jeff, who's an ally of women in construction. 67% of respondents for the survey that they did said gender-friendly safety equipment is not available at construction sites. There's basic things that we can do in the industry to empower more women to pursue careers and stay in careers in construction. Safety equipment is a pretty basic one. So there's other statistics that they included in their highlights here. 64% said gender-friendly restrooms were not available or were a challenge on site. 55% of respondents said that there is no adequate support system for women. And 85% of respondents said that there are no maternity-friendly safety equipment at construction sites. So, women are just structured a little bit differently, right? And I think back to my days on site when I was much younger. Oftentimes, there were no coveralls that would fit me. I'm quite tiny. I'm also quite short. I would wear coveralls that were four or five sizes too big because that's just all they had. That's the smallest size they had. Fall protection, same thing. They actually make fall protection for women, but on a lot of sites, it's just not available. So you wear what is made available by the organization. And, you know, unfortunately, that doesn't properly fit. And sometimes that creates a hazard all in itself. So we've made a lot of progress when it comes to women in construction, but we are still very much underrepresented in a male dominated industry. And there are small things, like these aren't big things. There are some big structural things. It's an industry we can look at and do better at, but you know, PPE, personal protective equipment that actually fits women, that is basic. Like let's get that right and we'll do a better job at attracting and retaining women in this industry. And you know, it's great to see surveys like this being done because we need honest feedback from women who are actually in this space. It's one thing to, you know, come up with programs and try and ideate and figure out, you know, how do we attract more women? How do we get more women to continue careers in this industry. But when you get real uncensored feedback from those women that are out in the field executing projects, take that feedback and action it. Don't put it up on a wall. You know, it's great that this report is out. Take it, read it, and do something about it. And I guarantee you will make women happier, more productive, more effective, and more likely to stay with your organization long term. Jeff, what do you think?
Well, I mean, you kind of mic dropped it there, but also I'll add to that, you know, it is those initial views. If you want to know your culture, everybody talks about their culture. Everybody talks about inclusivity, et cetera, diversity. walk into that safety and look for that PPE. That's actually a sign of your culture, right? You should know that that is your signaling, because it's not what you say, it's what you do. And I'll never forget this, because it hit me out of left field, Tanis. The PPE I was always big on, because in all honesty, like, there's just so many shapes and sizes of people in general that making them feel comfortable and making them feel included, but also safe, right? We want everybody to go home with, you know, 10 fingers, 10 toes to their families every night. So that is powerful. But the panel I was watching of women in construction, and she said, yeah, how many of you seen a pink porta potty? And I went, I never thought of that. Like, not at all. And they were like, yeah, racks and racks of blue ones. Where's the pink one? Where's the women's only one? Where's the, you know, we're all made a little different. Where is it? And it's a signal of your culture. And also then if you do those things, then the bigger part is then we will see you on a job site. Then women will see you. Girls will see you. Other people will say, hey, there's somebody I want to be like. And the recruitment becomes a snowball effect. It's what we need. And we need to highlight them. And we need to highlight people like you. This is the power of it all. So Lisa, I'm wondering what your thoughts on this are.
Well, a couple things. I actually attended a women in construction fashion show. So I don't know if you've noticed, but high-vis clothes are like trendy and on point. And I noticed I was looking in the whole kind of movement on like, what are women's bodies that have all changed? You know, this, if you know the song, Victoria's Secret was made up by a man, I always laugh at that one, but it's true. Mm-hmm. So that's happening. The other thing is, I think we need to be mindful. It's not just women, it's diverse people, right? So, yeah. I know there's pink, they're pink porta potties. I can do you better. I got an orange one called Wasted. And this is a company who I kind of like, I'm super intrigued by them. So one of the biggest, landfill parts of the equation are created from those porta potties, right? So this is a group in Vermont, is they figured out a way to, separate the parts of the porta potty. I'll let you use your imagination. So it can be reprocessed. So you can use it for fertilizer, and then you can also use clean water. So you have an environmentally friendly porta potty that's also environmentally friendly. Man, women, or whatever your combination you are would be attractive for that. So if I think about like the companies I would like to work for or work with to grow their business, like Wasted works for me because, first of all, I like this whole idea that you can have a circular economy, more sustainable, and you know we can do our plants and we can clean the water, and you know there's got to be a better way to improve like the environmental consequences of our pollution. So this is repurposing pollution. And it wasn't started by a woman, but I would think that women would be advocates of that as well. So I think we shouldn't sort of talk about men, women. We should talk about inclusion and different people who have different sets of criteria, and all of them have to be comfortable on the construction site.
Very well said. I think it was, I didn't know about that one. So that's one I got to go look up. Tanis, I don't know if you'd ever heard of that one, but it's cool.
I haven't, no.
It's cool. And what's interesting, it was a bunch of climbers. They climbed like Mount Everest or something. So I don't know if you know about Mount Everest, but they're like dead bodies along the way of people who like didn't make it. And nobody's strong enough to bring them down. I was like, oh my God. So they came, and I guess the other kind of waste product that's there, you can imagine what it is. So they came up with the idea of how do you create a porta potty? And again, you know, people think like there hasn't been much innovation in porta potties. That's a huge business, right? So you can also have a rate of return from your fertilizer, which you didn't have before. So it could be a win-win across the board. So those are the types of companies that I like. So I've actually tried to get in touch with Wasted. I'm going to like try again, but I don't know if they're up in Vermont. We got to have them come to America, to New York, right?
Got to get them to New York.
AM to New York, or we can go to Chicago. I know, Jeff, we should bring them to the Oracle site.
Yeah, we'll put these up on the Oracle site. There's another nugget for them. I'm sure they're listening in. Well, I am going to have to pivot us, but this whole alternative materials and alternative things is something that Tanis and I talk about quite a bit. I'll never forget, she actually brought me edible concrete. That was one of her articles back in the day. And I always wondered if I was ever going to come across it and then someone was going to be sitting there eating a building on me. I don't know. But this was a cool one. This is I'm going to call it Energix. It's a mission to become a worldwide leader in the global transition to sustainable energy. If you guys know, with the boom in electric vehicles, the boom in electrification, the amount of lithium that we have to extract from the earth, another limited material, we are not very good at it and we are not very efficient at it. And in some cases, possibly could be creating more problems than we're solving. But this company, just founded in 2018, has fundamentally changed the way humanity is empowering our world by and storing clean energy with direct lithium extraction and new refinery technologies. So they are now looking at how you extract lithium and doing it cleaner, getting 300% more out of it. And then the refining process itself, and saving more of the refined substance, and then innovating on the battery side to create smaller, lighter, more powerful batteries for the long term. And, you know, again, we have a tendency to swing the pendulum in technology, and, lithium is another limited resource. So maybe we can learn from what we've learned previously in extracting our resources and start to do it more efficiently and more powerfully. And also another one, they're actually, you can go invest in them right now. One of the other things that they're after is that circular economy, the ability to create a product in which you can reuse it down the road, which we all know you can't currently do with lithium. So Tanis, I was interested. This is a pretty nerdy one on my part, but I just couldn't get away from it.
I mean, I love geeking out on nerdy articles. That's my jam. We do it all the time. And just in follow up to the edible concrete, I have been following. No updates yet. So I'm still waiting to hear from somebody who's tried edible concrete. If you have, reach out to me on LinkedIn, because I need to hear how good it is. We need an update. We haven't had one yet. On this article in particular, I mean we geek out on sustainability all the time. Construction has a lot of room to grow and develop in the sustainability space. And when it comes to lithium extraction, EV technology, it's a market that's growing. The consumer market is growing. We're starting to see more investment in this space, and innovation is a result of that. It's no different than, small technology companies. I mean, Lisa, you talk to these tech founders all the time. The larger the customer base, the more they grow, the more they can explore and innovate. And it takes investment. It takes a consumer market that's there to support them. In the case of EV technology, I mean, there's been government grants and subsidies. I live in Canada. We actually put solar panels on our house because it was a government grant available to do that. And we have one car that is electric. And I mean, it's been a fantastic investment for us, and, great for just moving around the city and stuff like that. And had those opportunities not been there, I don't know that we would have invested as early as we did. So, I mean, this is the result of a lot of stakeholders in the industry pushing forward, and consumers included, helping to advance innovation in this space. And I love to see that. I mean, there's still a lot further to go. We've all heard stories about these, EV graveyards, cars that, the batteries conk out, and, there's no appetite to put a new battery in it because the battery costs as much as the car. So they end up in the, landfill somewhere. There's room to grow in this space, but there are also companies that are looking at repurposing those old batteries and looking at that circular economy. and how some of that material can be reused. So it's always exciting to see advancement in this space, still a long ways to go, but this is the result of investment and growth of a market. And we'll continue to see this hopefully going forward and more organizations, more tech startups venturing into this space to help increase the sustainability of lithium mining, extraction, and ultimately repurposing that material after it's hit its end of life in an EV battery. Lisa, what do you think?
I think it's a great idea, but since you're Canadian, I'm going to bring out a shout out. There's another company called Enerkin. So Enerkin is a company that has taken landfill and waste, and it makes it into clean energy. There's three sites that are across the U.S., and I'm like, go Canada. We need to have more of these. Because like one of the big problems is we do all this recycling, and no one wants to talk about it. The dirty little secret or the ugly truth is that China no longer buys or buys very little of recycling. So we spend all this time in recycling and it ends up in a landfill, right? So one of the big motivations in order to increase recycling is you have to, again, for the circular economy, you need to have an end use for it. So what Enerkin has done is they created a power plant. And these are larger. This is not a small company. This is my information is dated. It probably costs like $200 million. It's not chump change to build this next generation clean energy. But like, what a perfect thing where if you had a Enerkin facility next to a recycling or next to a transport station or a landfill station, and you take what would have been landfill boop, and make clean energy. Like, I think we should be doing that like all across America and the rest of the world. So I applaud Canada. Go Canada on that one. And the name of the company is Enerkin. There's another, I'm more basic than lithium batteries. So there's another technology which I really like, which is asphalt. So you know how we recycle all our plastic bottles? Well, you can recycle asphalt. It's called green asphalt. Mm-hmm. You basically clean it. You put in a material. And in Japan, almost like 75% of the asphalt is recycled. It's non-virgin asphalt. And the pushback in America is like, is the quality as good? I don't know. I've driven in America. I've driven in Japan. The roads in Japan are way, way better. So, you know, and last I checked, when we do our recycled bottles, do you ever notice a difference between your Poland Spring, like recycled or not? So I think, you know, really trying to push through these very small tangible solutions are what the mission of what I want to try to accomplish in this next chapter in my life.
Well, I'll throw one more at you. In our world, it's a little smaller. We had him on not too long ago, Eric Law from Urban Machine.
If you have not
seen this, they take lumber that normally would end up back in a landfill, and they've created a robot that you put the lumber through. And it uses AI and computer vision and a few tools to pull out all the nails and to get rid of everything in it that makes it not usable. And it can be taken back and be repurposed to use again.
Oh, I love it.
We're talking about fantastic wood. And talk about circular, because, you know, those trucks that come from, you know, your lumber station, they come to your job site and they drop things off and then they leave empty. But if you're running Urban Machine, they leave full. And they're small right now. They're really growing. But yeah, that's one for you, Lisa. Urban Machine.
Urban Machine. I'm writing that down. Okay.
We're sharing stuff today. So I got one last one, and this one's going to be, I don't know if I'd call it so nerdy, but if you guys have been paying attention, I'm a big Tech Brew and Morning Brew fan right there in New York City. So in your home area, Lisa, these folks put out some really good stuff. I got a lot of news that I have to get through. So I gotta skim. And they've been winning. But this one caught my eye for another reason. The clock may be going tick-tock on TikTok. A congressional committee voted unanimously on Thursday to advance a bill through the House that's tantamount to a ban on TikTok. Now, we can go into, you know, the semantics of what might be going on. And there is a lot about the algorithm that they use. And I mean, just on the outside, TikTok's algorithm is one of the most amazing algorithms that no one knows about, because it is one of the only few that you don't have to interact with. and it actually learns you, and it's pretty spot on. So there's some interesting technology going on there. But in the end, it's a Chinese-backed company that the U.S. believes China has a hand in, that they are possibly using it for. And it is known that they distribute and use different algorithms or use the algorithm differently in the U.S. than they do in China. And so they're looking at banning it. And this made me think about, Tanis, the ban on DJI drones. What I want to talk about, maybe less than the actual bans themselves and the validity, is understanding and sourcing your technology and making your decisions has to be bigger than just, I like this thing, right? You actually need to look at, where's it coming from? Where's it being created? I think, you know, we saw this with Kaspersky when, you know, it was a Russian backed antivirus program, and it caught a lot of flack when things between the US and Russia soured again, and with some of the malware and other things that were coming out of Russia. So again, it's just an interesting one to, do you really ever put, Tanis, who backed the company behind when you're taking that first look at that cool tool?
I mean, should you? Yes. Do you always? Not initially, right? You, as technology advocates, we often get drawn into the functionality and the problem solving capability of the solution. But ultimately, as you look at moving forward with serious evaluation of the solution or deployment within the organization, that's absolutely an aspect of the organization that you need to take a look at. There's a few points there. I mean, there's when you look at any particular solution, there are things that you are just going to subconsciously evaluate when you're looking at potential for use within your organization. One is going to be size of the company. Is it, you know, is it a 100-person organization, or is it, you know, somebody in their garage? You're also looking at, you know, financial runway. Do they have backing? Are they bootstrapping? If they're bootstrapping, is there a risk they're going to go out of business in 6 months and your deployment will, you know, ultimately just kind of crumble to the ground at that point? There are things I think everybody in the industry just subconsciously considers as they're going through the evaluation process. But to your point, the governance around that process should be far more structured, because you're running into these situations where you could have, you know, congressional bans on technology that you've invested heavily in. I don't know of any construction companies investing heavily in TikTok as their project execution tool. But I mean, ultimately, there are other examples, as you mentioned, antivirus software. I mean, if you're a small company and that's your primary deployment, and then all of a sudden, you know, the landscape changes and there's concern around use of that solution, yeah, that's something you absolutely need to be taking a look at. And, you know, I think a lot of organizations do a good job of having some sort of evaluation structure, but there are lots that don't, and, you know, sometimes don't even really go through the three bids and a buy process. They connect with somebody, they think the tech's cool, and they make an investment in it, and they're kind of off to the races from there. So I think this is a really good topic point for stakeholders across the industry. It doesn't matter if you're an executive, a project manager, an IT director, take a look at what your evaluation process for solutions looks like. And if you don't have something structured, it's time to start developing some sort of framework for solution evaluation and deployment. And that, you know, might include things like where your data is hosted, you know, how big the company is, who backs the company. You know, do a little homework. Find out what the company's all about. Find out what their values are, what their mission is. You're partnering with that company for potentially a long time. You know, don't date them once and jump in with both feet and get married. You know, get to know them a little bit before you make that commitment.
I like that. Lisa, you're shaking your head. You're in on this one.
Remember, one of my negatives was ethical behavior. Like, I don't want to invest in an entrepreneur. So it's basically the same thing. You need to understand who is in the cap table, who is the final owner. And for better or worse, I think there's sort of the court of public opinion. So you talked about drone. I'm okay with TikTok. You know, it might not be good for kids, but, you know, that's not my horse to back or not back. But when you talk about drone technology, I think that's a very much of a major security risk for the United States. So you can imagine, we work with a company called Aaron AI, and they use artificial intelligence to do inspections of bridges, and they're doing the Chicago Skyway and have a digital twin. And imagine if you're capturing that data, and that drone data can be used for an for a nefarious end. Like, you know, you talk about the scenarios of how many times have we been in a highway and there's like one closed lanes and there's traffic from here to Kathmandu, right? So when you think about air traffic control systems or traffic systems across the board, if someone can capture that and take advantage of it for an unpositive end or as a point of warfare, I think we have to be aware of that. And I was down at Wall Street during 9/11, and with all this like cool technology, sometimes it's this very small things and having the information that can, you know, bring a country to its knees, right? So I feel like infrastructure surveillance needs to be done by people that are authorized and they have security clearance. Like, you can't just walk into NASA without security clearance. You can't walk into the Pentagon. You can't walk into the CIA. You can't walk into the places like JFK, right? Because it's dangerous. You need to know who is capturing that data. And I personally, as an American, would be more comfortable if there was security clearance by the people capturing that data, and they would, you know, be more positively aligned to the American way of life.
I really like that point, because I've said this over and over, and I got my start as an IT person and security. And we don't think about it enough. And I've been talking about this on stage for a really long time, is that with the digital twinning, with our ability to do reality capture, we are creating a honeypot that we must be very, very careful on whose hands it's in and where that data is stored and who has access to it, et cetera. So, well put. I cannot thank you guys enough for sitting down and going through. Lisa, you're just as fun in the news as you were to interview. Thank you for taking the time out of your day to sit down and talk with Tanis and I.
I really appreciate it. I hope the conversation continues.
I think it will. Tanis, it's always great to talk to you. Always great to sit down with you. And thanks for joining me today.
Absolutely. It's great to be back. It's been a while since I've been on the show. So it was a lot of fun. Lisa, thank you so much. Absolutely fantastic interview. And let's definitely keep the conversation going. I think there's a lot of opportunity for us to continue to discuss some of these topics. And there were many points through the interview I was like, I could dig into that so much further, but we only have a short show. So more to come.
And thank you for tuning in today to Geek Out for our interview with Lisa Diaz. To read all our news stories, learn more about our guests, and to listen to this show, visit thecontechcrew.com. This is The Contech Crew signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.